But they need to
Today is March 21st, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is a continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, the Department of Human Services. Today we are going to be getting into the intellectual and developmental disabilities. But before we do that, I will turn to Ms. Wiley.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I have nothing to add other than that there is a presentation before you on the screen, as well as the same thing is posted in Obelisk for use, too.
Please let the record note that this is the first time that Ms. Byerly has nothing to add. And we'll bring up Director Tennedy and Director Psyche.
He is smart. He's on a roll today.
Yeah. I'm looking at too many ladies.
Chair Riffio, Chair Steinhaber, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. Before we move on to the presentation by Director Tennedy, I just wanted to kind of loop back and have a correction to some information we provided you during the APD hearing. When we spoke about provider rates, I believe that on the record I said that we had considered minimum wage but not compression in determining provider rates for APD. And really, I misspoke, because we did consider minimum wage for providers who were under the minimum wage and what it would take to bring them up, but did not really calculate that for the rest of the providers. So just want to go on record and clarify that. And with that, I want to introduce our director for our office of Developmental Disability Services, Lilia Tennedy. So Lilia has been the director of the office for 2.5 years, and that makes her the senior member of our program leadership staff, the longest tenured at 2.5 years. Prior to coming to DHS, she was a consultant in the IDD field, and she worked with several states to improve services to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and also help them to maximize their opportunities with federal funding through the Medicaid system. She also served as the director of the Illinois Department of Developmental Disabilities. As director of the Oregon Office of Developmental Disabilities, she oversaw the implementation of the Community First Option, or K Plan, as it's more commonly known. And implementation of the plan led to significant changes and improvements in the DD service system at every level. During her tenure, she's refocused the division to establish a vision with the goal of establishing a system where all Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities can live as valued members of their community. Her leadership and her professionalism has served the department and the people we serve very well. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to her to make her presentation.
Thank you, Director Psyche. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennedy. I'm the Director of the Office of Developmental Disabilities Services in the Department of Human Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to present on the work done by staff and ODDS and by our many, many community partners to support children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities throughout the state of Oregon. This is the presentation outline I'm going to be following over the next couple of days. I know that you will all have questions, and we will do our best to work through everything as quick, as effectively and efficiently, not necessarily quickly, as possible. Hopefully we'll make it through everything by the end of the session tomorrow. So we're going to be talking about a program overview, talking about who we serve, how people access services, because that's a little bit different than other areas of DHS for the DD system. Our accomplishments, including our Employment First Initiative, and then, of course, the challenges that we faced in 17-19, the investments that are proposed in the Governor's Recommended Budget, and our budget overview, and we'll be talking about our KPMs as well. As Director Psyche mentioned, one of the first things that I tackled when I came into this position a long 2.5 years ago was the fact that because of implementation of the Community First Choice Option and the significant number of changes that ultimately had to occur to follow that regulation, that ultimately made services available to a number of children and removed longstanding caps that had been in place for adults and in-home services. There was just so much change in the system that the stakeholders, when I talked to them individually and then as a group, there was concern about what we were doing and why we were doing it and where we were going as a system. And so we came together to develop this vision statement, which says Oregon's system of supports is simple to use and responsive to the strengths, needs, and direction of the people and families who live as valued members of their community. This is an important vision statement for us. Honestly, from my perspective, being in this role, I think the biggest challenge with this vision statement at this point is the work that we do every single day internally and with our partners to make our system simple to use. With the changes that have occurred and the things that have happened, we're just now getting to a point where we have a clear understanding of how people can access and all of the pieces that go into approving and authorizing services for the people we support. The next slide talks about our commitment to those we serve. We really want to focus and continue to focus on choice and self-determination. We want people to be integrated in the community. We really are focused on individuals, families, and advocates being a central player, a central voice in the role that they have in services. We also want people to be independent and productive. We're really focusing, as you'll hear later in the presentation, on helping people with intellectual and developmental disabilities access integrated jobs in the community. For us, for me, for anyone else who may not be part of who served in our service system, integrated jobs, that's just a code word for a job just like anybody else has in the community with your coworkers and peers and anyone else. We're also, of course, focused on safety, health, and well-being. Oregon is a recognized leader in serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in their communities rather than in institutional settings. Oregon was one of the first states to close all of its both public and private institutions and transition people into community settings. We, in this system, learned a long time ago that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities want the same thing as everyone else. They want to live in their community. They want to be a part of their community. They don't want to live in a segregated setting somewhere that's off, different from everyone else. Oregon also became a leader, ultimately, in the employment world when it established its Employment First policy, and then ultimately, a couple of years ago, also settled the Lane Settlement Agreement. The Lane lawsuit that we'll talk about a little bit later really pushed not only Oregon forward, but we do now, as a result of that lawsuit, have a federal court ruling or opinion that the Olmstead Act, which really pushed transitioning individuals into residential settings in their communities, also applies to work settings. And so that we want to move people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, give them every opportunity to work in jobs in the community with everyone else. At this point in the ODDS program, I always say we serve nearly a number at this point because our numbers continue to grow as a result of implementing the Community First Choice option. We serve nearly 26,000 people who experience an intellectual or developmental disability. It's about 8,000 children at this point and 18,000 adults. Our forecast through 17-19 continues this upward growth projection, putting us at about 28,000 adults and kids total at the end of 17-19. It's important to note that with this, when we bring...
Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. The increase of an additional 2,000 people, can you explain where that increase is coming from?
Yes. I will give my best effort. Co-chairs...
And maybe you're going to be getting into this more later, that's fine to postpone, but...
I can talk a little, Co-Chair okay. Steiner Hayward, I can talk a little bit about it right now. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield. Really, part of this growth is twofold. First off, with the implementation of the K-Plan, all children in Oregon who meet our intellectual and developmental disability criteria, which we'll see on the next slide, and are able to access services if they meet eligibility. So that is a change from before we implemented the K-Plan. Prior to the K-Plan, we had very small capped number of children that could be served, and only those children who really were in crisis situations had access to either in-home supports or residential services. And what's happened since then, since implementing the K plan, is these all children now are able to access in-home services with their families in their homes. The other part of this growth, as we look at where we're headed, and you'll see it on future slides, is adults coming into the system, 18 and over. This is something that would have been consistent with how the system operated before the Community First Choice option, with the Staley lawsuit settlement that occurred when Fairview closed. All adults, when they turned 18 with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Oregon, had the ability to access a capped amount of funding for in-home services, and that those who needed more level of support were able to go into our residential or comprehensive service program. We're seeing a growth in the number of adults coming in that we would have seen anyway, but the growth could be attributed at this point to, if you recall, in the 90s, early 2000s, significant growth being discussed in the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorders. Just in general, the CDC also around that time produced a study that talked about the increasing number of children who were getting, just in general, disability diagnosis across the board. And so we think, from my perspective, when I look at these numbers, I take it back to that point and look at those adults now aging, that cohort of children aging along the way, now coming into our adult system.
Yes, Senator Gilzer.
Thank you. In terms of the 8,000 children, I'm thinking of a situation in my community and wondered if this was the K plan. I had a constituent that had, at the time, probably a 12 or 13-year-old son that experienced autism on the significant end of the autism spectrum, was not eligible for any of the, they were just on a really long wait list for family support, so they were not able to receive any behavior support, behavior consultation, or respite in the home, so the child ended up moving into foster care. But I believe it was after the K plan that they were able to get enough supports that he is back at home and no longer living in a different city away from his family in foster care. Is that what that growth has looked like in the kids system?
Co-chairs and Senator Gilzer, without knowing more details based on what you've described, I would absolutely say that what you've described has occurred because of implementing the K plan. Children who otherwise would have been out of home, placed out of home, are now able to get supports in the home. And we'll continue to talk about that through the presentation, but based on what you've described, yes, I would say that that's a direct result of what we're talking about.
Thank you. And just one quick follow-up?
Please.
Thank you. And so, just to be clear, too, there's two different foster care programs, right? There's the child welfare program, and then developmental disabilities has, what, 350, 400 kids a year that are in DD Kids Foster Care?
Co-chairs and Senator Gilzer, yes, we have what we call IDD foster care, and those numbers will come later in the presentation. I don't recall them off the top of my head, but you will see them at a later slide.
Thank you.
Senator Sutter Hereward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, two-part question, and again, I'm fine with you postponing if you're going to be getting to this later. I didn't do a good job previewing all your slides last night. Do you anticipate, I mean, we're talking about, let's see, 2,000 on top of 26, we're talking about an 8% increase in this biennium, if I'm doing my arithmetic roughly correctly. And then do you anticipate going up by that much, or do you think we're starting to flatten out the curve? That's the first part of the question.
Co-chair Senator Steiner Hayward, excellent question. We actually engaged a research institute last biennium to answer this question because we were being asked it, obviously for good reason, on a regular basis. I was being asked. And so we looked at states that have comparable programs where basically anyone who's eligible has access to services. Those were specifically California and Arizona. And based on the research and the analysis that they did, we expect our numbers to level off in terms of people who are eligible, who understand what's available, who want to come into the system, coming in by early 2019.
Thank you. And another question?
Please.
Thanks. And again, I'm guessing you may get to this a little bit more, but it sounds to me from the way you've described it, you went from a system where the door was open this wide to a system where there was no barrier to the door at all. Do you believe that there's a fair, I think we would all agree that the case that Senator Gilzer described is exactly the way we would want something like the K plan to be working. We want families to be able to stay together with appropriate in-home supports. That's a much preferable way for our society to work. The flip side is maybe there are some families who are now in the system where you could sort of narrow the door a little bit and they would still be able to maintain their families together at home, but also use more natural supports or whatever the answer is. Is there a middle ground with how wide this door is open, or are we really in a teeny tiny little opening or completely wide opening world?
Co-chairs and co-chair Senators Steyer and Hayward, that question pretty much sums up everything I'm about to present for the next 2 days.
And I'll so, just be I'm delighted to be your straight person.
Okay. I mean, I can answer it now,
nope,
or we
nope,
can.
Nope,
okay, we'll get into it as we
it's
go forward.
Good.
Thank you.
I've got Senator Winters in this.
Thank you. And I'm not going to ask a question to follow. I want to go back to Fairview, because a part of the agreement of Fairview was also that they, when we sold Fairview, that those dollars for Fairview, particularly the interest, would actually go a part of the budget for services. Are we still doing that? And if so, how much?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we can. What occurred when Fairview closed is something was established called the Fairview Trust.
I was here.
Okay. Senator Winters, you can correct me if I go off course in my response then to what I'm about to say. The agreement at that time, as I understand it, was the funding would go into a trust from, and that the money of the trust that could be spent, the 5%, would go to fund, and did go to fund for many years, home modifications and assistive devices for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. At that point, about, if I recall, the 2011 biennium, if I recall correctly, the trust itself was about at $12 million of the corpus, and the remaining amount was going to those sorts of grants. What occurred, if I understand correctly, at that point, is that the decision was made to borrow.
I like that word better than the other one.
Borrow about $6 million of that funding to support the DD service system so that rate cuts and other things wouldn't have to occur. I understand since then that there was a pop that was proposed even in 2013-15 to restore the $6 million that didn't move forward for whatever reason. I don't know. And that again, when we are asked to look at items or things that we want to propose for reduction lists, the Fairview Trust does end up, the remaining $6 million ends up on the reduction list. And I can explain that now or talk about it later.
You can talk about it. My concern is that this is a legal binding document. It is not a document that can go away. And you know, it used to be every session some of those who were actually following this would make certain that this body knew that dollars had been either swept with the promise that it was going to be returned, that it was borrowed. And I'm still, because those dollars are to go to provide for the services of the DD population. And so I would, whether I talk to you online about that or talk to the budget folks, it is a commitment that was made at the time that we signed, that it was signed back in, I'm not going to talk about how many years ago.
Okay, Senator Gelzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I realize it's going to be a long couple days. Two, I love Senator Winters and the Fairview Housing Trust. And three, just back to the kids piece, and I know you're going to talk about it later, but I always feel like it's important to just put it out on the record. When I worked for DHS, I worked in the Family Support Program, and we went and looked at kids that were struggling. At that time, we had nearly 100 children living in nursing homes. We had close to 600 kids who were in foster care because the families could not access services. And you couldn't look at the eligibility based on income because the additional costs that families are addressing in order to meet the needs of their kids are pretty significant. So even the family that I talked about before, the father is a high school principal, the mother is a professor at Willamette, by any income level, if you looked at an eligibility in that way, they wouldn't be eligible for services. But as a public policy, it makes absolutely no sense that we would force children out of the home. I think the other thing that we found when I worked at DHS, I like to read things, and I did a study. I went through almost 500 kids who moved into out-of-home placement, and
many of them, it was for lack of really basic things like a lift when the child turned 12 or 13 years mm-hmm. old, and then they end up in a nursing home at $262 a day where they're separated from their family. And before they get there, their families, their parents' knees and backs and hips are all blown out, and they've gone on disability. So that as we look at the kids, I know that's a question that's come up, an issue that's come up, a pretty significant caseload growth. But I think that when we look at this caseload, we have to look at the care that families in the state have been providing for a very long time with very little assistance, and the crisis that that puts not just on the family but the siblings, marriages, and everything else. So I know those numbers are going to come up later, but it's difficult. The budget issue is difficult, but families are better, and I think our communities are better when we have kids at home and not in nursing homes or foster care. And I'm glad we've shut down almost all the nursing homes for kids. Kids do not belong in nursing homes.
Follow up on my question.
All right, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the Fairview Trust. You're taking the rest of the money out of the Fairview Trust? Is that in this governor's budget?
Co-chairs, Representative Buehler, the governor's budget recommends using the remaining amount of the corpus in the Fairview Trust to fund the DD system. So that is what's in the governor's recommended budget. I will say that putting together a reduction list from my perspective is always difficult. There's nothing on that list that is a good thing. I understand the governor ultimately then decides what goes into the governor's recommended budget, and then it comes here to the legislature.
Please.
Do you believe that that's consistent with the original intention of the creation of the Fairview Trust and upholds that commitment to people with disabilities?
Co-chairs, Representative Buehler, having not exactly been here but understanding from stakeholders what the intent of the Fairview Trust was, I think that it's important for us to recognize that the trust existed for a purpose and exists for a purpose to fund home modifications and things that now can be accessed through the Medicaid program. I think that ultimately with the K plan, the commitment that was in place for services when the trust was developed has also changed, and that services are available now through the K plan as opposed to needing to look to the trust specifically for things like home modifications. I will say I know that there is a group of the advisory group for Fairview Trust, which an ODDS, the deputy director for ODDS sits on. They are looking at new ways to use the money to help fund housing, because we know that housing is a challenge. So it's hard for me to speak to exactly what the commitment was and what it looks like. I will say, though, as we go through the budget, you'll hear about difficult decisions we've already made and are already implementing to reduce the number of authorized hours for the people we're supporting. And we'll talk about that in the context, just in general, of the budget issue. And those are the kinds of difficult decisions that ultimately the governor was balancing when she introduced the recommended budget, and ultimately you as the legislature will be balancing when you pass the final budget.
Yeah, and so you guys know, as we get further into this presentation, I think the answers to some of these questions will come to light, and we do have a lot of slides to get through. But so I'll do, we'll do a follow up. And I've got Representative Hayden and then Senator Gelzer.
I don't think the commitment to the Fairview Trusts is ambiguous. In my understanding, there is a written agreement.
Yes.
So I'm a little confused why you say that in your understanding. It should be pretty clear in that document what those funds were to be used for. And for example, what happens if the K plan goes away?
And so I think what we can do at this point, if you just want to maybe submit the written agreement to the committee, and then that will help answer some of the questions. And
I would like
it's in statute.
Yeah, and then we, okay, in statute, we can get that. And then we can kind of continue to move through this live presentation as well. So Representative Hayden.
Thank you, and I apologize, Co-Chair, for being late. I was testifying on housing for poverty. Just want to remind ourselves, basically, in the governor's budget, and put it on the record that 3 years from now, we have a strong suspicion that the K plan will not be there. And so to use Medicaid today as an excuse to eliminate Fairview Trust funds could be viewed as irresponsible. Thank you.
And I think for everyone on the committee to note that we have not made a determination as a committee to eliminate the Fairview Housing Trust. So, Senator Gelsinger.
And thank you. I think it's really important to recognize that when we have a director sitting in front of us, the director needs to speak to what is in the governor's proposed budget. So it's not entirely fair to ask Director Tennedy to address those issues. I would say the legislature, all of us unanimously passed legislation in the last legislative session to say, no, we are not willing to eliminate the Fairview Housing Trust and we want to pay it back. I think if we use that money to pay for services, we do that one time and then we have the same budget hole next time. Mm-hmm. It was a very sacred promise that was made that was specifically around housing. And what would be helpful to have would be a list of, have we actually approved any home modifications through the K plan? Because I understand from families and individuals that that has not actually worked out to be able to do that. So I'm very heartened to hear the support for the Fairview Housing Trust. I know as a matter of principle, I could never ever vote for a budget that include elimination of the Fairview Housing Trust. I said that when I came and that's kind of where I'm at. I could never do that and go home and live with myself.
You have a second vote on that motion.
All right, Senator Winters.
And as you know,
we will get off this slide, everyone.
It's been near and dear to my heart. So, I wasn't here the last session, but I'm here now. So, and I'll continue to track it. But I do have a question. When you send the a copy of the document to also, it may be well to send a little history of what's happened with those dollars so that members here who haven't been here would know, not only what the legal intent was, but also what we've been able to do over this years with the interest and also the amount of dollars that were promised to be paid back.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we will send everything we have about the Fairview Trust. Thank you.
Nicely done, Ms. Kennedy.
OLS will probably blow up.
Thank you. Moving on a little bit. The next slide just talks about the requirements for eligibility for ODDS or DD services. This is the general descriptions. There are lengthy OARs that go in statute that go into our eligibility criteria. These general descriptions, though, help people kind of get a picture of the types of children and adults that we support in the DD system. Generally, it's people with an intellectual disability. That's an IQ between 70 to 75 or lower, and a limited ability to handle day-to-day activities or functional. The person has required functional, what we call, unfortunately, functional deficits. We also serve people with developmental disabilities, things like autism spectrum disorder, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy. In Oregon, we also include fetal alcohol syndrome as one of the diagnoses that we do that falls under our eligibility category. Ultimately, everyone must meet our financial eligibility requirements for Medicaid services. And it's important to note, I think this is something that we end up missing sometimes in these discussions, that the deficits or the challenges that people have related to these diagnoses cannot be related to a mental illness or substance abuse. So we really are looking purely at intellectual disability and developmental disability when we look at eligibility for people in our system. This next slide.
President Alonso Leon.
Oh, excuse me.
Sorry, that last comment you made that I'm assuming you do still serve children with disabilities if they have mental disabilities, right? I just want to make sure I understand that mental disability isn't required for you to serve them.
Co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon, excellent question. What we look for in how we determine eligibility is that the primary reason that the person may not meet may not have the level of functioning that would not make them eligible is that it's associated with the intellectual disability or the developmental disability. We absolutely, and we'll talk about that more as well, we absolutely serve both children and adults that have co-occurring mental health issues, personality disorder issues, and an intellectual developmental disability.
Thank you for clearing it up. Thanks.
All right. This slide looks very confusing, and the reality is that how people access ODDS services can be a little bit confusing for those not familiar with how our system works and how where our front door is. For developmental, intellectual and developmental disability services, our front door is not actually state staff. It's not state staff field offices throughout the state. It's our partners at community developmental disability programs. Community developmental disability programs were established in statute as the door to the DD system many years ago. By statute, a county can operate a CDDP. They can choose to contract with another entity to operate the CDDP, and we pay the county and they do a subcontract, or the county can say, we would prefer not to have anything to do with this state, thank you, and you can find the CDDP entity to contract with. We, across the state, we have all of those types of situations. We have counties that run the CDDP, we have counties that subcontract the CDDP, and then we have parts of the state where we contract directly with a private entity to run the CDDP. So the functions for them are all very similar. They determine eligibility. They do our adult investigations, our adult protective investigations, and they do foster care licensing. So each one of the CDDPs, no matter where they are in the state, that's the function they perform. And depending on where a person is in the state, that's the door that they go through to determine eligibility and start the process of receiving services for ODDS. They also provide case management services, which is also provided by our brokerage. That blue box in the middle of this slide talks about our case management entities, CDDPs, brokerages, and for some children, we do have Oregon ODDS state staff who provide that function. So the front door is the Community Developmental Disability Program. Ultimately, once the person is determined eligible, the type of case management entity they go to is oftentimes driven by their age and the primary service need or primary service that they're looking for. For children, in-home services and foster care are case managed by service coordinators at the CDDP. Children with the highest level of needs that are in our group homes and our in-home, what we call Children's In-Home Intensive Service Program, those are the ODDS state staff, about 31 state staff, and our CIIS and Children's Residential Program provide service coordination for those children statewide. Then for adults who go into in-home services can choose between CDDPs and brokerages, and then the CDDP provides case management functions for group homes, foster people in group homes, foster homes, and supported living. I will note that this drawing I caught last night, it's one of those things when you look at something repeatedly, you think it's right, and then you realize it's not at the last minute. This has been reloaded on OLIS with the correct drawing, so if you printed or looked at an earlier version, this has been corrected now. I just wanted to show that.
So what's up on the screen is correct?
Yes, what's up on the screen is accurate.
Okay, then there are two things about this that confuse me. The first is I would have thought of the arrows going the other direction, which is to say that the brokerages or the CDDPs are the ones who provide the services, but that's a semantic issue more than anything else. So I just want to make sure that I'm understanding that you go through a brokerage or a CDDP to access the various services, right? It's not like so that's a how I look at the world versus how you look at the world. It's not a big deal. I just want to make sure I understood it correctly. But the bigger question I have for you, and perhaps other members of the committee have for you, is why do we have both CDDPs and brokerages and ODDS employees dealing with all of this? And why is that a system that serves the people getting the services better than having fewer different entities providing these services? Because in some cases they're different, but I would have to imagine that CDDP programs could provide some of the things that brokerages, in fact, the only thing brokerages provide, at least according to these diagrams, are in-home services, which CDDPs are also doing. So I'm confused.
Co-chair Senator Steiner Hayward, what you see in this slide is a reflection of a system that has evolved over time, and this reflects where we're at today. I will explain a lot of things that happened when the K-Plan was implemented. What happened prior to the K-Plan with the Staley Settlement Agreement was that something called brokerages were created to provide supports to most of the adults we served, because most of the adults we served were not in residential settings. And what they provided was a brokering type service based on an individual budget. Everybody had an individual budget that they could access services with, of about capped around $20,000. There were small variations depending on the needs of the individual. And the broker, the personal agent, worked with them to identify what services they need, how to spend that money, and then to help them support them in the community. The brokerages became ultimately case management entities a while ago, a long time before K-Plan was implemented, and took on the role too, not of just a brokering, but of being case management entity for all the people in all the adults receiving in-home services. That's in statute, and that's how we function and operate with those brokerages today. The CDDPs, as a part of how they were established and developed, could offer case management service. And the way the system used to work before we went into the K-Plan was the CDDP provided case management for adults in the comprehensive service, in the comprehensive system. So adults that were in group homes, adults supported living or foster care, their case management was through the CDDP. Prior to K-Plan again, children, not many children were getting in-home services at all, period. And the CDDP managed a small amount of family support grant funds that they would give to families to try to help them maintain and sustain without having to need out-of-home placement or something more drastic. Prior to K-Plan, the kids with the most significant needs, the kids who ended up in Children's Residential Services or the CIS program, they were case managed by a small group of state staff that existed for our CIS waivers and our Kids Residential Program. What happened with the K-Plan was a decision made by the DD leadership at the time, and I will correct Director Psyche just a smidge. I was not here when the K-Plan was implemented. I came in about a year afterward and picked it up from there. So, sorry. No.
She was here for all the good parts of the K-Plan.
So basically, decisions were made prior to my getting here, and for reasons I, to this day, don't completely understand, to open in-home management of in-home case management for in-home adults and in-home services to CDDPs and brokerages. And so what has happened over time is that people can choose between a CDDP and a brokerage for their in-home adult in-home case management service. And the thing with case management that makes this the moment that we're in, and the thing that I've been thinking about, frankly, we've had a lot of discussions around case management as stakeholders. The thing that makes it very challenging is that you want the case manager to be have a relationship with the person. You want them to be their primary point of contact. You want them to be someone they trust to contact and talk to. And so at a point when we've got this going on and that we've added thousands of people to service and they've all gone through this model to select their case manager, talking about telling a large group of people that is no longer an option for you, for your case management entity, is very, very difficult. And so we are discussing what our case management systems should look like. We do value in the DD system, as you saw on an earlier slide, choice in, you know, being able to determine who provides your service. And so these are all discussions that continue right now. We haven't gotten to the point where we have finalized, okay, this is our long-term vision for what case management looks like, but that's the discussion we're engaged in. What do we want this to look like in the future? How do we, to your point, and to the vision statement, simplify this so people understand what's going on and make it a more cohesive process.
So, okay, I think you've mostly answered my first follow-up question, which is you're thinking hard about what else this could look like at some point in the future and how to maximize both efficiency and continuity of care, which is something I obviously believe in a lot. And as an entirely rhetorical point, I would say that I admire your commitment to building that trusting relationship, and I wish to heck we were able to do that in child welfare too, because those children, as much as these children in particular, deserve that kind of continuity, and they don't have it. And that's not your issue, but I think it's important for people to be aware that you are working very, very hard to provide a system where kids and adults get the continuity that they deserve, that provides the highest level of service at the lowest cost. And our most vulnerable children, our children in the child welfare system, don't have the luxury, or the benefit. It's not a luxury, it's the necessity
always of that kind of dedicated, committed, long-serving case management, and that distresses me no end. And I realize it's off topic, but I couldn't resist.
Senator Gilzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add something to the idea of the case management versus the brokerage, and this is from a completely personal kind of experience. I've got a son who experiences the adult DD system, and when he became an adult, the K-plan had been implemented around that time, and again, Director Tenenty was not here. Some of us were asking how that was going to save money to move from a capped waivered service to a birth to the grave entitlement service that went to everyone. Obviously, that is going to be more expensive, and obviously, that's going to bring in more people, and that's not DHS's fault. That's a decision that we made, and it's going to keep costing more because it's a choice that we made. But when we looked at that, it was important to me that we had a choice between the CDDP and the brokerage program. In the brokerage program, we would have managed, or he would have managed those services more, which also meant that he would have had more choice, he would have had more control, he could have chosen his people, but as his guardian, I also would have needed to manage all of the employment issues. I would have had to deal with any issues that there were with payment to providers, and that was not something that I felt that I could take on. Going through the CDDP, they were able to help us choose a provider agency that manages all of the payroll and the employment. For some families, there aren't great providers in their communities. We were lucky to be able to find one, but having that set of choices allows a flexibility across the state to meet the individual needs of families and really allow adults with disabilities to have, and I think it's really important to use the word support rather than care, but to have the support that they need to have really full lives and make the choices that they want to make. So I think it works well on the ground. It's not as confusing as it looks up there when you're choosing your case management entity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sarah. That's helpful.
Please continue.
All right. This next slide just talks about the important role of case managers that I've already talked a little bit about in responding to those other questions. We look at our service coordinators and personal agents to assess the needs of the people that come into our system, to develop the most important document from my perspective, which is called an individual support plan that really identifies a person's goals, their desired outcomes, what they want to achieve, and how we can support them to what services or natural supports that might be needed to help them achieve those goals. They also provide referrals to services. They help them find the type of provider that they want. They do monitoring for us, so they're the ones on the ground, really engaged with people, knowing what's going on, and then they do a level of follow-up, just making sure that things are okay and that services are working as planned. I think this is an important slide to call out, and the role of our case management entities through CDDPs and brokerages is important to note because they do really, with a ton of respect from me, take on the work that we might do at the state level from a policy perspective. They're the ones on the ground who are dealing with the day-to-day and implementing whatever we might come up with. And sometimes that works out well, and sometimes they teach us a lot about how to think about things differently. So I just want to call that out as we're going through the presentation. The next slide, I get asked a lot what type of services we provide or supports. The majority of people that we support, as you'll see in later slides, access some type of in-home service. These services help people develop skills. We talk about here cooking and shopping and how to integrate and learn to be in their community. They help them prepare for work. A lot of our initiatives around employment really focus on the need for providers who aren't specifically the employment provider to help support the person thinking about and engaging in and being ready and willing to enter the workplace. Types of providers that provide this support are our personal support workers. These are the direct hired types of workers that Senator Gelsa referenced. We have about over 14,000 of them right now throughout the state that provide services. We also, our agencies, our DD provider agencies also provide in-home support. So there's just a number of people that provide, a number of type of providers that offer this type of support. For the other type of service that we talk about a lot is our residential system, our residential services. We look to our residential providers, foster care, group home, and supportive living providers to provide a similar kind of support, helping people develop skills, prepare them for work, interact with peers. We also look to them to provide behavioral support services directly in the in-home system. People can go through another private entity to do that. We also really look to them, ultimately, in a lot of ways, to provide housing for a person. So a person in a residential service is either living in a group home or a foster home. For supported living, it depends a little bit based on the person, but generally, housing is a component of what is available to the person when they go through these types of services.
Mr. Chair.
We also have...
Question from a budgetary standpoint, and looking at the services that are provided in home versus the services that are provided in, whether it's foster care, group home, do you have all that separated out as to what budgetarily you're spending in each category?
We do, and that'll be a part of our budget slides as we go further on, and I'll be sure to point, we can talk through that as we go through. You'll see in just a few, I don't know, a few or many slides, maybe either today or tomorrow, kind of that kind of information. Thank you,
thank you.
Senator Winters and co-chairs. We also have our state-operated stabilization and crisis unit. These are group homes that are scattered throughout the state, up and down, really, five corridor. We have about 21 residential group homes. They serve up to 10 kids. The rest that are served are adults. This is where folks, children and adults with the most significant needs are served right now at this point. If you look at who we have in SACU and who we have waiting to get into SACU, it is, to the point we discussed earlier, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities who also have some kind of co-occurring diagnosis. Those are the folks that present the biggest challenge for their families, if they live with family, for other providers, private agencies, if they live in private agencies, and that ultimately that we are just working constantly to identify and support appropriately. The Stabilization and Crisis Unit actually had a legislatively directed task force that met and over a period of time and came up with some recommendations with the help. We also had a consultant come in and make some recommendations on things that we could do better and differently at the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. We're also implementing a credentialing program at Stabilization and Crisis Unit for our direct care workforce there, our direct support workforce. It's a National Alliance of Direct Support Professionals, and we'll be talking about that throughout the presentation. That's a program that allows direct support professionals to really receive training, pass a competency-based assessment or a review of materials that they put together, and then gain status, if you will, as they work their way up a credentialed career ladder.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator Winters.
So as they work their way up, help me, because I had a constituent in a group in yesterday from Medford, and one of the questions that they raised for me was the differential in wages and resources, and you know, they were really targeting the state op group homes, and I still say that. So I explained the difference in the work environment and the demands and what have you for this particular population. It would be helpful because not everybody understands even that particular component was created after we closed Fairview. And it was in recognition that all things being equal, there was no all things being equal, that we did have populations that would require a more 24-hour set, not only just 24/7, but also some special skills. So I want to know what's the level beyond the stabilization crisis unit.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, for people in the IDD system, the Stabilization Crisis Unit serves as our crisis placement. We do have private agencies that are able to support people with similar needs, but
when they crash, when they have problems, they end up here.
That's accurate. When those agencies have challenges. We have people who are that go into SACU. Honestly, about 44% of the people that we have in SACU right now came from private agencies. And there's a number, obviously we can have a discussion, there's a number of reasons for that. I do think the direct care workforce issue that we're going to be talking about as we go forward is a big part of that, and a number of other things that we're working through in the system. So the state-operated group homes, as you refer to them, were established were established when Fairview closed. And the population of people, though, it's important to note that we have now at the Stabilization Crisis Unit has shifted since the closure of Fairview. We do have still roughly 20, I want to say, people who came from Fairview and are still there. They aren't the type of person or the people that we're talking about that have the significant challenges with co-occurring mental health and intellectual and developmental disability challenges. At this point, if you look at who we have coming into Stabilization and Crisis Unit, it's the people with those level of significant needs. So we're in, and this came out in the task force discussion as well, just wrap this up with saying this, we're kind of in a moment with the Stabilization and Crisis Unit where we're still meeting the needs of the people who came in from Fairview, but we're also really focused on shifting to what we know is the need in our system, which is more the crisis for the individuals with more significant needs. So thank you. Now we'll get into our numbers and answer some of the questions that Co-Chair Steiner Hayward raised earlier. This slide just shows how the number of children we have accessing services. And it's broken down by type of service. You'll note that where we've seen the largest growth since 13-15, the K plan went into effect on July 1st of 2013. It took the DD system about that year to kind of really figure out what was going on and get itself to a point that it was in mild level of chaos instead of extreme chaos. And you'll see that growth from 13 to 15, 17 really is just the full understanding of what is available through the K plan, what people and children coming in the door to access in-home services. To the point made by Co-Chair Steiner Hayward earlier, this is one of our challenges, is looking at how we're funding children in through the K plan. It requires, based on the federal legislation, that it be done based on activity of daily living or instrumental activity of daily living need. And that's something that for children with the highest level support and need, like the kids we have in CIAS with behavioral issues and significant medical challenges, and the kids going into group home, I can see, you know, as a system that's reasonable and that makes some level of sense. For kids who have intellectual and developmental disabilities, providing some level of support to the family that may not be directly tied to an ADL, IDL might be something that we look at as we go forward, so that the family has the ability to get the rest and recuperation and the thing they need to continue to support the child in the home.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Steiner Hayward.
Those are terms that I know well, but some other people on my committee, I don't know if everybody else knows what ADLs and IADLs are, so you might just want to give a couple of examples of the differences.
Sure.
Just to help the committee understand what you're wrestling with.
Co-chairs and Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, thank you. That's the problem working in a field. You throw around the terminology really easily with forgetting that maybe other people don't know it, so thank you. Activities of daily living. So under the Community First Choice Option or K plan, the way the federal regulation is structured is that we need to do an assessment of a person's ADL or IADL needs. That means can the person feed themselves? Can they use the restroom properly? Are they mobile? Do they need support getting from place to place? Do they need someone supporting them either in a chair or with a gait belt or some other type of support? So there are a number of different, our assessment goes through a number of different activities of daily living, things that a person might need support for. Do they need help accessing the community? Are they safe? If they go out, will they talk to a stranger and end up in an unsafe situation? So there are just a number of things that we assess as part of the following the K plan regulation, and then we derive funding or hours of support for in-home services from that assessment. And again, for kids, especially children with the most significant need, it makes a lot of sense. We're helping that family maintain. We know that we've got families who, prior to the K-plan, were staying up all night trying to help their child with medical needs. We've got a family with a child named Gloria who's very young but has significant medical needs. The K-plan has allowed them to get somebody to help overnight. But it's trying to balance what's the appropriate amount of funding or way to fund for children and adults ultimately in a way that is budgetarily responsible but allows us to continue to provide a wide door for support.
Please, Senator Wears.
I'm glad you, this particular issue, I just yesterday, I had one of my constituents who has a child. Mm-hmm. Who requires assistance from us and support. And the issue is that there was across the board 30% reduction, according to the father. Both parents work, which means that they're trying to do all that they can, and without our assistance, and this particular child has, if I went down on the checklist, he's 4 years of age, but the percentile of growth is at 10 months. So two things. How was it determined the percentage of the reduction, number one, and number two, the appeal process that is in place for the family to appeal that, because you really want the family him to remain in the home. And then number three, one of the things that we talked about yesterday, how long it took him to get a little child walker for this child. And one of the things that he said to me is that, he said that it's an automatic denial on the request coming from the individual to the community. And my question is why?
Co-chair.
Particularly since we should have the record of this family and the diagnosis of the child and what have you.
Co-chair Senator Winters, I'm going to try to go through each one of those questions.
And we can take this offline, but are questions that I think that for me would be, why is denials automatic, number one? The issue of across the board 30% without looking at the actual factors that are involved with the family. So we can go offline on this, but I really would like to know those issues.
Co-chair Senator Winters, we actually will be talking about the 30% reduction is tied to something that a step that we took with our stakeholders and with the direction and involvement of the legislature to reduce the hours of in-home support that we were authorizing. So I'll be glad that'll be later. We can talk about how we're doing on that and what the exceptions processes are at that point. In terms of the equipment and the things like that, it should not be an automatic denial. We do require, and this goes back to some extent with questions about how people are accessing home modifications and equipment, because it's a Medicaid funded service, there are requirements that have to be met. One of them for things like equipment and the thing you're talking about is a denial by the health insurance company first before Medicaid will take it. And so I'd be glad to have an offline discussion with you and look at the situation involving that particular family. I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you.
All right, so just wrapping up on this slide, you continue to see, this is where the discussion came in earlier, that we continue to see a growth in the number of children we expect to come into the system to access in-home services in the 17-19 biennium. The next slide talks about our average cost per case. This breaks it down by service type. And then later on in the presentation, probably at this point tomorrow, when we get to our overall budget, you can see how these funding mechanisms apply to our overall budget. Foster care, we expect a little bit of growth. Group homes, the increase we're projecting for children's group homes here, all of these, this projection includes the POP that's included in the governor's recommended budget to increase provider rates to help support our direct support workforce. And then in-home supports are, you see we have the highest number of kids in that program, but in general it is our lowest cost service because people are living at home with families and not in a 24-hour residential type setting. The next slide shows you similar data for adults accessing service. We continue to see growth in the number of adults coming in-home supports. I think some of the factors relate to the discussion we had earlier, as well as now that we're getting kids into services when they turn 18, they're automatically continue to be in services and are reflected in the growth as well. In terms of this chart, I will say we didn't put stabilization and crisis unit on here, but as I mentioned, stabilization crisis unit serves about a little bit under 10 kids each time, and for adults it's under 90, about 90 to a little bit less than 90, depending on who's coming in and who's going out of the stabilization and crisis unit. So while it is our most expensive service setting, it serves the smallest number of people in our system. The next slide does show our cost per case for each of these broken out services. Foster care, supported living, which we shifted in supported living when we went into the K plan to funding based on an assessment of those ADL and IADL needs, which based on how the service had been funded prior to the K plan did cause an increase in the amount of funding available or the cost per case for that service. We're seeing that level off now as we've gotten more people into the system, more people into services. The supported living and the group home numbers include an estimate of what the cost per case would be if the governor's recommended budget is adopted with the POP in it that I mentioned earlier. So you'll see kind of how our service costs are going up. In-home supports for adults and, quite frankly, for children, part of the cost you see increase you see reflected there is a result of collective bargaining agreements that occur over periods of time, and then also the move that we took along with Ashley spoke to it when she was here as well to implement the U.S. Department of Labor regulations on overtime. So that's part of what's driving these numbers. And I will say, because we mentioned it already, just in terms of the stabilization and crisis unit, it's not on this chart, but our cost per case right now is running about $48,000 a month for people, for those less than 100 people in the stabilization and crisis unit. We have an initiative that I hope many of you, most of you, all of you have heard about already, but if not, I will give as much information as I can at this point. This is the Employment First initiative that I referenced early on in the presentation with the goal of helping people with intellectual and developmental disabilities access employment in their community. This is a collaborative effort, not only with ODDS, but also with Vocational Rehabilitation and the Oregon Department of Education. So for children who are transitioning from school into IDD or VR services, we're all collaboratively working to make that transition process as effective as possible, but also to have it meet the needs of these kids in terms of getting them ready for work in the community in a way that that this focus has grown over the past couple of years because of this Employment First initiative. We've increased the number of youth and adults with IDD who receive employment services. We continue to support the transformation and expansion of providers providing integrated community job coaching and other types of services. We have decreased the utilization of sheltered workshops. And for those who may be new to this discussion, sheltered workshops are settings where people just with disabilities go to work, and they're paid based on the amount of work they do. Some of those folks do make minimum wage, some make below minimum wage. The Employment First Initiative and the Lane lawsuit that we'll get into on the next slide, is it the next slide? On a future slide, as a matter of fact, relate to our efforts to try to help people in those settings transition out of sheltered workshops and access jobs in integrated community settings. We also have CMS regulations around home and community-based services where we're really working to help people be access services in more integrated settings in their community.
Yeah. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yeah, going back to minimum wage, so can you explain to me why our folks would be making less than minimum wage if minimum wages are lowest pay rate?
Co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon, sheltered workshops, some of them, well, all of them technically, I think, have an exemption by that's given by the U.S. Department of Labor called a 14C exemption that allows them to pay people with disabilities less than minimum wage. And the way the wage is calculated, and I'm giving a very high level description of this, is that if you have a person without a disability doing this work, how much time does it take them? And then you have the person with a disability doing the work, and you prorate what you pay them based on the comparison to what it would take a person without a disability to do the work. And that is a very high level, probably missing out a lot of factors, explanation for how that wage is determined.
Please.
Okay, so can you give me an example of what below minimum wage is? So what are these folks making?
Co-chairs, representative, it depends on the person, but they can ultimately make cents on the dollar a day, depending on what's going on.
Senator Gilson.
Mr. Chair, when you say cents on a dollar, do we have some people that are making as low as 25 cents an hour in Oregon?
Co-chairs, Senator Gelser, I can't speak to specific numbers, but that would not surprise me based on how funding and wages are set in these type of environments.
And just as a comment, it would be really hard to pay your rent making 25 cents an hour, 40 hours a week, and a minimum wage is a minimum wage. And just because it's the federal law doesn't mean it has to be the Oregon law. We could kind of buck immorality and do the right thing for people with disabilities and value them as equal people and guarantee that they make the minimum wage.
Yeah, follow up, Chair.
Please.
Yeah, it just didn't sync well with me to know that we have folks working to the best of their ability and they're making below minimum wage. Certainly, how are we going to expect them to feel like they're contributing if they're not making at least minimum wage? How are we going to help them realize that they do have their own abilities and potential to live a life with dignity if they're making below minimum wage? So this just didn't sync well with me, so I appreciate Senator Gelser's comments on this as well.
Co-chairs, thank you, Representative, thank you for those comments. This is a big, our Employment First initiative is specifically to help people who are in those settings. Many of them are making minimum wage, to be fair, access jobs in the community and leave those settings. We actually, as part of the settlement agreement and the Employment First policy, closed the front door to those settings on July 1st of 2015. So we're working with the people who are currently in those settings to transition to other jobs. We're working with those providers, giving them grants to help them transform their model to support people to do more job coaching and job development in the community as opposed to in that environment. And we've seen just since from 2015 to 2016, about a 27% decrease in the number of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in those settings. So what you're talking about is a big part of what the Lane mm-hmm. lawsuit and this Employment First initiative are about.
Thank you.
All right. And, I didn't remember the order of my slides. So here we are talking about our accomplishments. And one of the big accomplishments we do have, really for this past year, has been the Lane versus Brown settlement agreement. Essentially, there was a lawsuit that I've mentioned now several times where the U.S. Department of Justice, Disability Rights Oregon, and named plaintiffs sued the state for violating the civil rights of people, not being able by not allowing them or giving them better opportunity to access jobs in the community, and instead really focusing on what we've been talking about, the congregate work environments for people with disabilities. We ultimately, after a number of years, reached a settlement in that lawsuit about 2 years ago now, if I recall correctly. Or maybe it's probably less than that, I'm sorry. We reached settlement in that lawsuit and have an independent reviewer now that both us as the defendants and the plaintiffs meet with on a regular basis to look at the progress we're making and what we're doing. That independent reviewer just submitted her first annual report to the court because we've been under the settlement agreement now for about a full year, and we met our expectations in the settlement agreement for year one, which is a huge accomplishment not only for us and ODDS and VR and the Department of Education, but also for all of our community partners and our providers and families and individuals who have benefited from this settlement agreement. We provided employment services to 2,971 individuals. Our required target was 2,200, so we exceeded our target. We established and promoted a goal that we want people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to work at least 20 hours a week, if not more. We continued to provide grants, the grants I talked about, to our providers to really incentivize and encourage them to transition into providing people support to get jobs in the community. And we also increased our percentage of adults working 20 hours or more a week. And I should note, I missed it on the first slide, the pictures of the women in these slides, Ashley on the earlier slide, and this is Mimi, these are actual recipients of services, and they are working in their community. Ashley works 20 to 30 hours a week at a cafe in the Mid-Columbia Health Center. She also works, she's very busy, she also works at the Columbia Basin Care Facility as an activity aide. She helped identify the goals that she needed and the types of skills she needed to get a job through her youth transition program. And so she's one of the youth that we talked about who transitioned from school immediately into an integrated job in the community. We also have Mimi on this slide. Mimi is a young woman who works now she was also a participant in a transition program. She works at the Grange Co-op near her home, and she wants to save money so that she can get her own apartment. So for these two slides, we were able to identify specific people that we share their stories as part of the successes with this particular initiative. So thank you.
Sure. And are these thank you. And are these women making minimum wage or higher?
Yes. I actually have wage information for them that I don't have right in front of me, but yes, they are definitely making minimum wage or higher.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on with our accomplishments over the past biennium, we continued with our sustainability efforts. Ultimately, that's what we're calling the reality that, or the work that we're doing to look at how we support people in Oregon with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but how we do it in a way that's consistent with staying within the legislatively approved budget at a reasonable growth rate. Ultimately, different than, I would say, how the past couple of bienniums and have worked out because of how we rolled into the K-plan. I think everyone can understand when I say once people are able to access a particular benefit at a particular level, coming back in and having a different discussion about that benefit is very difficult, but that is one of the things that we are doing and have continued to do over the course of the last year. We started our realignment effort, which is the effort I mentioned earlier with Senator Winters, where we met with stakeholders. We looked at budget data for what we were seeing in in-home services. Specifically, when we rolled into the K, there was a very quick move to get an assessment in place, and there wasn't a lot of time for testing or validating or looking at what it allocated in hours. And what we were seeing in general for all ages and across the board was that we were authorizing a higher number of hours of in-home support than people were actually using. And so we implemented with our stakeholder group, our vision group, looking at that. We shared a number of different data points. If we reduced it by 20%, it would look like this. If we reduced it by 25%, it would look like this. with their guidance and involvement and talking to members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee, we agreed that we would move forward with reducing our hours of authorized in-home support by 30%. So, for example, if somebody who went in a year ago and had an in-home assessment done that said you qualify for 100 hours of support, when they go in, everybody gets assessed annually. When they go in the next year, this year, they'll go in, and that same assessment, ultimately, if they haven't had any significant change in need, will indicate that they get 70 hours of support. There are exceptions processes. We do have people going through exceptions processes and Medicaid appeal rights. We've had 243. We started doing this with people currently in services as of November 1st of last year. We started it with new people in on September 1st to just try to start bending our cost curve. Since we implemented, we've had 243 exceptions requests, people saying, wait a second, I need more than what you've allocated, and here's why. We've approved 91 of those. We've denied 107, and we've got 45 that are pending, waiting for more documentation. So since September, November of last year, 243, when we serve, you know, a significant number of people, that's actually a pretty low number, first off, of people going through the process. But secondly, when we're looking at it, we are approving those that we think are appropriate and meet the criteria that we've established. We've also had several Medicaid hearings. We're waiting for the results of most, but in the three decisions we've received since implementing, our decision has been upheld. Each time, so we're continuing to monitor that. And this, I will say, has taken a significant amount of time and effort and understanding from the individuals involved and the families, from our field service coordinators and PAs, and from ODDS staff in our central office who are reviewing all of the exception requests that do come in. Even with that, even with this reduction that we've done, which seems monumental, it's really just a first step for us. We can't stop now, ultimately, in looking at what we're doing. We expect that this will bring down spending on in-home services by only about $6.4 million in 17-19, which it turns out to be about $22 million when you add the federal match plus K-plan in actual services. But this is an example of steps that we are taking, a significant effort that we've engaged in that ultimately just begins to bend our cost curve. We're also continuing discussions with our stakeholders about what our system looks like going forward, how we meet that balance of what adults and children.
And Director, why don't we go ahead and stop there?
Sure.
I was hoping we might be able to get through these accomplishments, but I think people need to get off the meetings, and so okay. I think it would be important for them to hear this information. And so what we can do is go ahead and start with the Oregon Needs Assessment Pilot on slide 18 tomorrow. And that way, I think it's just important that everybody hears that. Ms. Byrow, is there anything else we need before tomorrow?
Nothing aware, Mr. Kutcher.
All right, very good. So sorry for interrupting in the middle, but we'll just pick it up tomorrow. So.
Thank you.
All right, thanks so much.
Yes.